The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
There is a single unit within the GRU that is responsible for a lot of these disruption operations, including the Skripal case, including the poisoning of this Bulgarian arms manufacturer, the coup in Montenegro. It all leads back to one unit.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 25th, 2020. Before we get into it, though, let me urge you to also check out another Lawfare Podcast feed, the one for our audio narrative, The Report, which we are now using to bring you a distilled version of the president's impeachment trial. Just the core arguments, without the punditry, the repetition, the breaks, the milk drinking. Just a fair representation of the significant things the senators are hearing in that room. It's called The Impeachment, and you can find it wherever you find podcasts. Just search for The Report. On this episode, the past few years have seen an uptick in Russian covert actions across Europe, including assassinations and attempted killings of people in Ukraine, Bulgaria, Germany, and the United Kingdom. Just this week, Bulgaria charged three Russian agents with the poisoning of a prominent Bulgarian arms manufacturer. Michael Schwartz has been an investigative reporter with the New York Times for almost 15 years now. He's been tracking this Russian skullduggery carefully in many of those countries for much of that time. And recently, he's reported on how quite a bit of that activity is linked to one particular unit within the Russian GRU. I sat down with him in the Jungle studio to work through this increasingly aggressive Russian action and what it all means going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 500. Yes, that's 500. Michael Schwartz on Russia's lethal actions in Europe.
Let's start almost 15 years ago now, back in 2006, I think it was in July that the Russian Parliament's upper house approved a law that allowed Russians to do something legally that perhaps they had been doing, but without that legal sanction. What happened?
Right. That was the year that Vladimir Putin signed a law that basically allowed Russian intelligence operatives to target and assassinate individuals outside of Russia's borders. And in the time, that was sort of taken in the context of Russia's ongoing war with Chechen separatists in the south of Russia, in the Caucasus region. There had been several significant assassinations of Chechen terrorists and separatist leaders outside of Russia, and this sort of formalized it. But very quickly, that changed, and it's sort of a different type of individual started to be targeted for these types of operations.
And if my memory serves correctly, there had also been a recent murder of four Russian embassy employees in Iraq at
Correct.
The hands of an al-Qaeda affiliate. And the Russian justification for this was interesting, wasn't it? They pointed to the West and said countries like Israel and the United States are doing things like this.
Right.
So, of course, we can make it legal. That's Correct. Not how everyone else around the world saw it, though.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, not that long after, we had a case that most of our listeners are familiar with, the case of Alexander Litvinenko, poisoned in November of 2016, certainly by the British investigation, with the involvement of Dmitry Kovtun and Andrei Lugovoy, who are, of course, back in Russia safe now, but the famous polonium-210 in the tea. This put a lot of international attention on Russia and its willingness to go after dissidents, former government officers, anybody who perhaps was some kind of a threat to the regime or somebody who could be, a sense, a target of revenge for the regime. And it seemingly, in the aftermath of that, cooled off for a while. But a few years ago, you started reporting on a whole lot of things that were happening and converging, and I'd like to walk through some of those with you.
Sure.
If that's all right. Let's go to 2015, the poisoning in Bulgaria of an arms manufacturer. Who was he, and why did this look like a Russian activity?
All right. This individual, he's one of his name is Emelyan Gebrev. He's one of Bulgaria's largest arms manufacturers. And he manufactures mostly light arms and ammunition, so mortars and things like that. And he had a fairly successful business for Bulgaria, selling weapons. Usually to his clients were usually states, so governments, militaries.
Okay.
He had big contracts with India, had contracts with several countries in Africa, and he at one point had a few contracts with Ukraine as well, which, as we know, Russia was fighting a war with or began fighting a war mm-hmm. with through proxies in 2014. And so in 2015, a year after that war started, in fact, Gebrev was having dinner with some business partners at a hotel in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria, when he started to get violently ill. He started vomiting everywhere. He lost his vision and then started hallucinating wild and fantastical creatures before blacking out entirely. And initially, both he and Bulgarian prosecutors, you know, believed that perhaps it was business rivals. The Bulgarian prosecutor didn't even initially believe that he had been poisoned.
And there was wasn't there some reason for this? Didn't his son and another business associate also have symptoms?
Correct. His son and another business associate also had symptoms, which should have been a clue that something else was going on here, because all of these three individuals were in different places when they fell ill, and they fell ill on different days. But the case was quickly closed, I think about a year after the case was open. It was closed due to a lack of witnesses, the lack of suspects. But eventually it was determined that, in fact, this was the work of Russian assassins, particularly from Russia's military intelligence unit, the GRU. And this is a sort of this military intelligence operation has gained a lot of attention recently, particularly since 2016, because this was the group that was involved, according to the U.S. intelligence assessment, in hacking into the Democratic National Committee servers in the Clinton campaign.
So this is definitely one of those cases where something happened. Obviously, something happened, but it wasn't a big flashing light saying Russian GRU. That developed later in light of some of the other things
Correct.
That you've reported on. Okay, well, let's get to some of those. By September of 2016, you had a mysterious Russian who, by your reporting, got a list of six people in Ukraine, and one of them ended up dead. What did he do? Tell us what happened and how you connected with this Russian.
Right. Well, this was a strange case in which an individual was murdered in a very small Ukrainian town in the far west of the country. So very, very far.
A very anti-Russian area.
Very anti-Russian, but also very far from the conflict line in the east, where Russia had been involved in a separatist conflict with Ukrainian troops. And this individual, you know, he did have a military background, but for all that I could determine, he had not been involved in the war in the east in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and had been retired for some time. Mm-hmm. And was working as a prison, not even a prison guard, but a prison. So he sort of worked as an engineer at a prison in this local town.
This is the person who was murdered,
right?
You're
the
talking about
the person who was murdered, right? And it's similar, actually. It's a case that bears some resemblance to the poisoning of the arms dealer, because when it happened, people believed it was some local problem he may have had with local mafia. There's sort of a big amber smuggling business, a black market amber business in the region. People thought that he had, you know, been involved in that in some way. Hmm. Nobody would have thought that Russia would send an assassin. I don't know how I calculated it at one point, but many, many miles and many, many days travel from the Russian border to kill this man. And yet, you know, I went to this town and visited a prison where in fact, an individual who said he was an assassin sent by Russia was sitting and on trial for the murder of this man.
And unlike many, many people that you talk to regarding Russian activities abroad, this man was willing to open up.
Right. I've talked to a lot or attempted to talk to a lot of people involved in this sort of thing, both victims as well as perpetrators. And this is the first time I had ever had anyone sort of open up so fully and give what appeared to be just sort of a full accounting of what had happened.
And what is that story? Why did he say that he was going after this person who, by most accounts, shouldn't be high on any target list? He was not a prominent politician. He was not a prominent dissident. He was not a former Chechen commander.
Right.
Why was this person, and presumably the other five on the list, but particularly, why was this person the target of his attack?
Well, this is a long and convoluted story, and it really speaks to the way in which sort of the Kremlin thinks about enemies and revenge and vindictiveness. At first, the individual, his name is Oleg, Oleg Smorodinov, the assassin, didn't quite know why he was tracking this guy. And in fact, in many ways, I think he still doesn't quite know why he was sent to kill this individual. He was given an order. He was given a payment. He was given a gun and sent off and received a text message at one point just indicating that it was time to kill this guy. And he fulfilled his duty, went back to Moscow and was paid both in cash and in the form of this Mercedes van that his handlers had given him.
And he probably should have stayed in Russia, but why did he go back?
He definitely should have stayed, but he had a kind of obsession with a Ukrainian woman that he had sort of a long and torrid relationship with. And he had gotten it into his head that he was going to go back to Ukraine for her birthday party. Informed her of this, she clearly didn't like the idea. And she had had her suspicions that he was up to something criminal in nature for some time and informed the Ukrainian authorities that he was crossing over the border. And that's how they arrested him. But the story of why this individual, Ivan Mamchur, prison worker, was murdered is a much more complicated one. And it took me a little bit of time to put together. And I did that with the help of a list that I found on the computer of the assassin. He had given me at one point access to his passwords and put me in touch with a nephew of his who had taken ownership over all of his different devices back in Moscow. And I had recovered this list of six names that included the victim in this case and five other Ukrainians. And by piecing together and doing some research on the names in this list, I was able to determine that while in fact all of these guys had a military background in Ukraine, none of them appeared to have been associated with the current war that is still ongoing in Ukraine and has cost something like 13,000 lives. They were all associated with a different war in Georgia in 2008.
The Russian war with Georgia,
exactly.
Not the Ukrainian war.
Yeah, a Russian war with Georgia, a war in which Russia won handsomely and quickly and ended with a real embarrassment, both for Georgia and for Georgia's backers in the West, particularly the United States. But what had happened during the war in Georgia was that the Ukrainians had provided the Georgians with sophisticated anti-aircraft weaponry just prior to the war breaking out. And the Kremlin believes, and I've never been able to establish definitively, that there were Ukrainian military officers who were assigned to either oversee these anti-aircraft batteries or actually operate them.
And maybe even just some technical workers,
correct,
like electricians,
correct,
hint, hint, like Mamchur, who were there, but the Russians have long memories for these kinds of things.
Indeed. And in fact, these anti-aircraft batteries were quite successful in shooting down a number of Russian planes which took the Russians completely by surprise. They weren't aware that the Georgians had this sophisticated weaponry, and they didn't take the measures they might have taken to preserve their planes. And so they lost quite a few planes for such a short conflict, and several of their pilots were killed and captured. And this, you know, caused extreme consternation within the Kremlin. Putin himself spoke about it publicly, vowing revenge against whoever had allowed the Georgians to obtain these weapons and whoever used them. And this, it seems, was the purpose of Oleg's trip, this assassin's trip to Ukraine, to start meting out this justice, you know, a full 8 years after the war in Ukraine, in Georgia, excuse me, had ended.
And to the best of your knowledge, the other five people on that list are still with us.
The other five people on the list are with us. I was able to find several of them on Facebook, actually. I actually met with one of them on sort of condition of strict anonymity. Right. And this individual admitted that he was, in fact, in Georgia during that time, but said he was not involved in the war. He was involved in some other business. Mm-hmm. And it's still unclear to me whether these guys ended up on this list simply because the Russian government had information that they were simply present and assumed, because they had military backgrounds, that they were involved in some sort of military action against the Russians, or simply were just happened to be there at the wrong time and were swept up in a kind of faulty, not quite clear Russian intelligence operation.
Right. We'll get back later to the issue of the assassin and his profile. But you raise an interesting issue here, which is that this is 2016, and this is the year of very active Russian activity, the year of elections and sabotage. Of course, you mentioned the interference, the information warfare, if you will, against the U.S. election that the Mueller investigation uncovered. But in the middle of October of the year, the failed coup attempt in Montenegro that the Russians, at least a trial a year later, pointed the finger at a couple of Russian citizens.
Right.
You also had some activity in Moldova, I think, that year. And that all built up to an impression that something had changed, that some kind of switch had been flipped that was opening up Russian activity in this new space, this shadow war, as Jim Sciutto calls it, but operating below the threshold of direct armed conflict, but certainly more aggressive than they had been in years previous. It wasn't limited just to these kinds of efforts, though. You also reported that in late 2017, there was an unusual extradition request in Spain, the kind of which you hadn't seen much before, involving a Russian that was wanted by the FBI. Hmm. What happened in that case?
The Russians and the United States have been carrying out a kind of proxy war over the extradition of various hackers or cyber criminals. And there have actually several of these individuals who happen to be swept up in Spain and subject to extradition orders. And these always result in a diplomatic fight between the United States and Russia. Russia at times will promise, just send them back to Russia. We'll prosecute them here. We have our own system of justice. We'll take care of it. Obviously, the FBI is not interested in that. What's interesting in a lot of these cases is that oftentimes the charges that are published against these guys are charged purely with carrying out sort of cyber criminal activities. So that's stealing identities, hacking into banks. We've seen this rash of ransomware attacks on whole cities, particularly in the United States in recent years, which has been a particular favorite of Russian cyber criminals. But what we know is that the Russian intelligence services often piggybacks on the work of various cyber criminals. I wrote about one in particular who was a very prolific cyber criminal who had written and utilized a particularly pernicious form of malware. And what we were able to learn about him is that the Russian intelligence services were, in fact, piggybacking on his network, his botnet, and using it to not exfiltrate banking information, personal information of that kind, but login and passwords for Defense Department officials, government officials, diplomats, as a way of getting intelligence. And so in a lot of these cases where you see these extradition cases, you don't quite know whether The U.S. authorities are going after them purely for their cyber criminal exploits, or whether there's something sort of more nefarious in terms of national security going on.
And you don't know what the Russians know about that either. So the Russians putting in an extradition request, in that case to the Spanish authorities, right after the FBI had requested that the Spanish arrest the person. You don't know. Is that because the Russians had been working with the person and they needed to protect that activity from U.S. questioning? Or was it just to mess with the United States in the same way they were messing with a lot of Western countries in that time frame?
It's really hard to know. And I think there are numerous examples of the Russians acting in a way that is sort of purely to mess with the United States, though certainly they will act to protect their interests and protect their intelligence networks and information gathering networks, certainly.
Yeah, moving forward just a few months, we have a case that most of our listeners are familiar with, but let's remind them of the bottom lines on what developed and what we know now about the early 2018 attack on Sergei Skripal and Yulia.
Sure.
And give us the bottom lines on that, because it turns out that has some connections to some of these other activities.
And this was a case that evolved relatively quickly, simply by virtue of the aggressive response from the British. And what we know now from the British investigation is that a group of Russian operatives from the same military intelligence agency, the GRU, arrived in Britain in early March 2018. A couple of them traveled to a small cathedral town called Salisbury in England, and they approached the home where a former Russian spy had been living and smeared a highly potent nerve agent on his door handle, took off. This former spy, along with his daughter, were exposed to the substance, ended up becoming sick and losing consciousness in a very public place. First symptoms were noticed in a restaurant nearby, and then they walked to a park and fell unconscious on a park bench, where they were seen by a number of witnesses. And this attack, which the British authorities quickly traced back to the GRU, caused a massive international incident. It was the first time that a chemical weapon, a nerve agent, had been used in Europe as an attack like this in anybody's memory. It caused a huge diplomatic backlash, both from the British and their allies. I think it was something around 120 diplomats were expelled. You can assume many of those were believed to have been intelligence operatives assigned, working under legal cover at embassies. This was right before the Russian elections. It was right before Russia was due to host the World Cup soccer championship. And so there was just a lot of international resonance in this, and it sort of woke the world up to the kind of malign activities that Russia was engaged in. It's not the same as some of the things that we'd seen before. This isn't them going after. Separatist leaders in the Middle East or in Turkey or elsewhere. This is a residential area in a major NATO country using a volatile substance that could have killed many, many more people.
It also built on the British experience, because after the Litvinenko attack, it took them quite a while to both diagnose it as polonium-210, and then to decide what to do about it, and then to try to work with the Russians to figure things out, and much longer to actually accuse the Russians officially. Whereas having had that experience, in a sense, helped them move more quickly on this case, even though it was a different poison, if you will, being used.
And I think, the difference between 2006 and 2018 when it comes to Russia is a stark one. The British in 2006, and I think the West at large, saw Russia and Vladimir Putin as somebody perhaps who had strayed a bit from the kind of democratic hopes that they had harbored for Russia in the 90s and early 2000s, but as somebody that they could work with. There were Russians with enormous amounts of money and pouring into Britain in particular, bringing lots and lots of wealth into the country. And there was a sense after the Litvinenko poisoning in 2006 that, you know, okay, this was bad, but, you know, you need to focus on other priorities. You know, we need to, you know, we're better off working with Russia ultimately as partners rather than as adversaries. If you fast forward to 2018, it's a totally different scenario. Russia had in 2014, 4 years earlier, moved into Crimea, which is a sovereign part of Ukraine, and annexed it for itself, held a kind of sham referendum in which the Russian state took over sovereignty of that region. It was, you know, in the midst of sponsoring a separatist war in eastern Ukraine, and there have been a number of other issues. And of course, in 2016, was assessed to have aggressively meddled in the conduct of the U.S. presidential election, as well as elections in France and government functions in Germany and elsewhere. And so the Brits in 2018 were looking at Russia very, very starkly as an aggressor.
So definitely a difference in the British reaction, but also shockingly, a real difference in the Russian reaction to that reaction. Because after the Litvinenko blow up, the Russians basically, you know, played dumb and obstructed the investigation as much as they could, but they tried not to draw more attention to it. They let it fade away. Not so in this case. The 1 year anniversary of the Skripal assassination attempt, if you will, the Russians, they held a news conference. They released a report rehashing all the details. They gave extensive coverage on RT and other media, and they publicly accused the United Kingdom of not only refusing to allow the Russians access to consular activities, but also they accused the United Kingdom of forcing their detention and even the abduction of people involved. What a difference. It's a very aggressive stance at this point.
And I think that is this iteration of Vladimir Putin, right? This is the Vladimir Putin of the war in Syria, where he has deployed thousands of troops in order to bolster his ally Bashar al-Assad and engage in a punishing air campaign that has killed scores and has been accused of targeting civilian infrastructure like hospitals. It's the Vladimir Putin of the 26th election meddling. This is a much more aggressive Vladimir Putin, and sort of it's not only my assessment, but it's you know, the assessment of many Russia watchers, that this is an effort by Vladimir Putin to use the tools that he has. He is no match for the United States militarily. He's no match for the United States and China and others economically. But he does have these tools and subterfuge and international skullduggery and these sorts of things. These are tools that have shown themselves to be fairly effective at keeping the West off balance, at causing no small amount of disruption. If you want to look at what has happened in the United States, no, I wouldn't put that solely on Russia, but certainly they played a major role in that. I think he knows, and these practices have borne out that Russia can really project its influence and really sort of mess with his adversaries by using relatively cheap, relatively easy methods that are deniable, and they're going to continue to deny them, and it will be impossible for Russia's adversaries to, you know, engage in any kind of debate with them on this, because this is sort of the line they're going to take after each one of these things: deny, 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 and never give an inch.
And one might argue that they were emboldened because the cost of doing these, even as some of them became known to the public, were uncovered, the cost was minimal.
Right.
There was not any severe pushback enough to stop Putin from feeling emboldened.
Right.
By these activities.
And I think it's hard, you know, it's you know, this is an area where I'm certainly not an expert, but in terms of response, I think the West finds itself very limited in what it can do in response. You know, you could kick out every Russian, you know, declare every Russian diplomat persona non grata, but then you risk the same being done to you in Moscow, and the, you know, the, it's valuable to have a presence on the ground in these places, if only to keep open dialogue on various things and keep an eye on things. You know, the sanctions, you know, the United States continues to ramp up sanctions, as do the Europeans. Now, that coalition is sort of a fragile one, but that hasn't curtailed Russia's behavior. I think it has certainly affected the economy. It has certainly put the pinch on Russians, but it most definitely has not affected Russian behavior at all. And Putin certainly knows that the West is not going to go to war with Russia over the death of a spy, or the poisoning of a spy in Britain, or some weapons manufacturer in Bulgaria.
And one result of that is what you reported on that happened in the fall of last year in Berlin. Talk through that a little bit and what we know about the Russian activity that led to another death.
Right. And this case, sort of, you know, it's similar to, in many ways, to all the other ones. You know, there was a sort of brazen assassination in the middle of Berlin.
Who was the victim in this case?
The individual was a man by the name of Zemlikhan Khangoshvili, who is rolls right off the tongue. In fact, despite his last name, is in fact an ethnic Chechen who comes from a region in Georgia close to the border with Chechnya. This is the North Caucasus region that is to the south of Russia.
And as soon as you say Chechen, that brings up the minds of the Russian effort to go after former Chechen commanders and people involved in that long conflict from the 90s and beyond. Is this related to that?
This individual clearly falls within this category. He was involved, as far as we can tell, in both wars in Chechnya. Mm. There was an absolutely vicious war in Chechnya that started in 1994, shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union, and another war that started right as Vladimir Putin was taking the helm, first as prime minister and then as president in 2000. And this individual was involved. It was a separatist commander. He fought on the separatist side both times in both of these wars. You know, Russia launched a punishing campaign to pacify the local population, basically destroyed Chechnya's capital, Grozny, and sent a lot of these fighters into hiding, both internally and abroad. And this individual had sought refuge in Georgia, where he was the target of several assassination attempts there, moved to Ukraine at some point to determine that he wasn't safe there, and moved on to Germany, where he had settled in recent years in Berlin, though continued to be worried about his safety. And that's where an assassin carrying a Russian passport, a newly issued Russian passport with a fake name, found him and murdered him in a park, sort of in broad daylight, in the middle of yet another European capital.
And in contrast to some 13 years earlier in the United Kingdom, where the Russians at least made a show of pretending to cooperate with the Litvinenko incident, they didn't do much, but at least they pretended to care. In this case, Russia just denied it and, in fact, ignored German requests for information.
Right. And as best I can tell, they continue to ignore these requests for information. I mean, you know, it would be standard investigative procedure. The German authorities have a guy with a Russian passport. You go to the Russians for information about him. And according to the Germans, the Russians have just not at all been forthcoming with any information about this individual. And for the longest time, this individual's identity was unknown. And I think it was only until about a month ago, several weeks ago, that German authorities, based upon an old Russian Interpol wanted Interpol red notice, learned his real name and discovered that he had been involved in another assassination several years earlier.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a few steps back from all this, because looking at all of these incidents, they all have a nexus around Russia. They have some different kinds of targets. That is, some actual Russians, some Chechens, some other people who seem to have been Ukrainians but involved with things that Russia cares about. And they also seem to involve different parts of Russians. That is, there isn't one person like James Bond walking around across decades doing all of this. But you did find just a few months ago that there is a nexus for not all, but a lot of this involving one particular unit within the GRU. talk through what you've learned and how it applies to several of these cases.
Right. And a lot of this information came out of this new posture in the West in the wake of the Skripal poisoning. And this can't be overstated how aggressive the Western response was and how alarming this attack was. If you can have operatives sort of traipsing around Europe carrying, you know, highly toxic nerve agents, that puts your citizens at risk. This is not sort of, you know, operatives sort of dueling it out in a game that's kind of, you know, outside of, outside of, you know, politics, outside of sort of local realities. This, you know, in the British case, a British civilian died and several others were sickened as a result of this. And most assessments say that it could have been much worse. And so the British with the help of colleagues in other Western intelligence services began boring down, trying to learn as much as they could about the individuals involved. And they started to see some patterns. You know, they looked at travel data and started to tell, you know, and this might be an operational mistake by some of these operatives, that some of these guys were using the same passports, not their actual names, but the same aliases for years, traveling all over the place. And you know, Western intelligence services began tracing their movements and trying to line it up with line up these movements with various things that have occurred in different countries over the year. And they you know, as they're looking around, they had this ha-ha moment. And this eventually led them to a determination that there is a single unit within the GRU that is responsible for a lot of these disruption operations, including the Skripal case, including the poisoning of this Bulgarian arms manufacturer, the coup in Montenegro. It all leads back to one unit, which in the Russian designation is called Unit 29155.
And that seems strange, but we have to remember from the Mueller report, we found out there are units within the GRU with five digits that are responsible for certain operations.
They all have these number designations, and these units became famous during the Mueller investigation because these are the units that were involved in hacking into the computers of the Democratic National Committee and setting up methods for disseminating this information.
So walk us through what we know about this unit and what we don't know, and then what you assess. That is, what your thoughts are about its size, its ability to wreak havoc across Europe.
Right. We don't know a lot about the unit. Only recently have Western intelligence agencies discovered that it has a name and a designation and a specific purpose. They do know that it has a headquarters in Moscow and possibly several, you know, headquarters designed for training and others for administrative purposes. We know that its operatives are highly secretive, that you know, I've been told that other GRU operatives probably do not know that this unit exists and certainly are not aware of the activities that it's involved in. The operatives that we have become aware of, both through the Skripal poisoning and others, all appear to be veterans of various wars. You know, almost all of them fought in Chechnya. They fought in Ukraine. Many of them have received Russia's highest military honor, which is the Hero of Russia Award that is bestowed, I think, semi-annually by Putin himself. So these are individuals that are known to Putin, who have met Putin, and who are, you know, carrying out these operations for specific destabilizing purpose. What we don't quite understand is how they pick their targets and oftentimes why their targets are selected. I had a really hard time investigating this poisoning in Bulgaria because time and again I went to people who told me, you know, who basically told me that it sounded ridiculous that this highly trained Russian unit would go after a guy. Sure, maybe he's encroaching a bit on Russian interests in the arms trade, but certainly shouldn't seem worthy of a targeted assassination. Certainly not the caliber of, say, a Sergei Skripal, who truly sort of betrayed his country and sold out his colleagues and was an enemy of the Russian state. This guy, you know, he may be a shady businessman and he may have sort of, you know, crossed the wrong people. But why he was a target, it's hard to say. The coup in Montenegro is something easier to understand. Russia is very much opposed to countries in its periphery, particularly countries in the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact that are showing signs of getting closer to NATO. And this Montenegrin coup happened right at a time then that Montenegro was finalizing a deal to join NATO. So that very much fits in line with what we would expect. I mean, it's a bit more aggressive, I think, than most people had expected prior to Skripal. Right. But that sort of fits into a pattern. Another thing that is puzzling both to me and to the people I talk to about this group is that they don't necessarily, at least as far as we know, have a great track record.
Right. We're not talking about elite assassins here. In several of these cases, we're talking more about thugs, people right. who are just there as almost being used as throwaways, and maybe they'll succeed, maybe they won't, but it doesn't look like these are highly trained security professionals being asked to do these jobs.
Right. Well, there are a couple of things here. There are, there are in these cases, in the cases that I'm following, particularly in the cases of 29155, these are trained operatives who are within the chain of command, who mm-hmm. are on the pension, payroll, and they haven't been particularly successful as far as we know. The Skripal case, they ended up not killing him. They certainly sent a message if that was their goal, but they didn't kill him. In the Bulgaria case, they didn't kill him. They weren't able to effect their coup in Montenegro. Montenegro is, in fact, a member of NATO today, and so none of these missions were successful. However, what I've been told is that perhaps we don't know about the missions that were successful because they were successful. That's hard to argue. But another thing to keep in mind, I think, is that this unit, 29155, is not the only unit that is carrying out these types of activities. If we go back to the Litvinenko case in 2006, the British government assessed that was the work of the FSB, which is primarily considered Russia's domestic security agency, sort of akin to the FBI, but has been known to sort of engage in activities abroad. And, that was seen purely as a revenge operation because Litvinenko was himself a member of the FSB who defected. The case in Berlin, again, we sort of don't have a lot of details about how that came together, but according to sort of the people I talk to who study this sort of thing in the intelligence world, this does not seem to bear the hallmarks of a Unit 29155 operation. Those operations are normally handled by the operatives themselves, whereas this operation seems to have been carried out by sort of a hired contractor. And that's more in line with what we sometimes see with the FSB. They will basically use proxies, like criminals, hired hitmen who were sort of they've taken from the criminal world, let out of prison, and brought on to do a job. This is a very similar circumstance to the one in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, with this guy Oleg, who I had met there. He was not, as best I could tell, a member of Russia's security services. He was kind of a ne'er-do-well petty criminal the security services had picked up to do a job.
Sure.
So there are a bunch of different ways these sort of operations can happen, I think.
Let's hit the implications of all this, and we'll do it through a twisted version of the old game Clue. Remember, you used to identify who the murderer was, in what room, with what method. Well, we know who's doing a lot of this, at least in a vague sense, in terms of Russia. But in terms of who is going to be murdered and where and by what method, if you are one of these many different categories of people Russians have gone after. We've got people involved in the Chechen Wars. We've got people who are involved in the conflict with Georgia. We've got former Russian oligarchs and former Russian security service officers abroad. You've got Ukrainians. You've got shady arms dealers. If you're in any of those groups, how worried are you that someone in Russia is looking at you as a possible assassination target?
Well, Russians tend to be fatalists anyway, so I don't know how many of them are actually worried, walk around worried about this sort of thing. But I think the point of all of this is that it sends a message that anybody can be targeted anywhere, that our reach is, our reach is long, and you may think that there's no reason for you to be a target, but you're a target. It's just to send out this message again of Putin sort of, and I should specify that I don't know, and I don't think that Putin sort of signs off on all of these things. Mm-hmm. I think he sets a tone rather than. So I don't believe he's much of a micromanager.
Who will rid me of these meddlesome
priests?
Right.
But I do think that sort of the message is what's important. The message is, and it's Putin using sort of the limited resources that Russia has to have an outsize effect. So you don't need to be sort of rounding people up and putting them in gulags. You don't need to be going around the world assassinating lots of people. You can do these simple targeted attacks that send a very, very big message.
Everybody has to think twice now.
Right. We're not to be trifled with. And if you're thinking of trifling with us, this is sort of the fate that awaits you.
And you've already mentioned the where. And you told a particular good story of somebody who was, you know, in the Caucasus and then said, well, maybe Ukraine's safer. And then said, well, maybe Ukraine's not safer, but Germany should be safer. Well, Germany wasn't safer. And the United Kingdom isn't safe. And perhaps all of Western Europe now isn't safe. Is there anywhere that is? Do you think this Russian unit could conduct similar attacks in the United States itself?
That's a question I ask. I ask, you know, my intelligence sources all the time, whether there's ever been any evidence of any indication that these sorts of operations have been planned or carried out in the United States. And the assessment has generally been, you know, that the risk is so much higher in the United States that the Russians have so far largely refrained from carrying out these type of operations here. But there was a case from a few years ago that was pretty interesting, and we still don't have a whole lot of detail on this. There was an individual, and it's a very murky case anyway, and it goes back to the Skripal case, in fact. There was an individual who was, I suppose, a longtime mole for, I don't know what agency he was working for, probably the CIA, in Russia. And it was this individual who is the one considered to have exposed this network of sleeper cells that were expelled in 2010. This is the whole Anna Chapman thing.
The Russian illegals.
Correct, that sort of inspired the Americans. This individual, right before FBI agents went in to arrest this network of illegals, this individual hopped on a plane, I believe with his family, flew to the United States very, very quietly and was settled somewhere out of sight. And it was about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, we reported that U.S. authorities had detected efforts by the Russians to surveil this individual, that this individual had been. I don't know if the individual had been located, but there were definitely defined efforts to surveil this individual in the United States, and whether this was, you know, part of an effort to eliminate him, or just an effort to sort of keep an eye on him, you know, and understand what he was doing. But this sort of led in a sort of very James Bond kind of way to an effort by the U.S. intelligence to fake his death. And so it was sort of let out of the bag that he had died, and you know, falsely let out of the bag that he had died. And it was picked up in the Russian media that he had died when, in fact, he was alive and well. And for all we know, is still alive well somewhere in the United States.
So we've talked about the who and the where, but we haven't really hit the how. Unlike that game Clue, the Russians probably aren't going to use a candlestick to do one of these whack jobs. But they have a long history of things almost to that point. You go back to Trotsky with the ice axe in Mexico City, or in London in 1978 when the Bulgarian dissident Markov was knocked off with a ricin pellet from a special umbrella to inject it into him. But even in the more recent years, we've had a variety. We have had the plonium-210. We have had the nerve agent with the Skripals. We've had, in the Bulgarian case, I think it was centered down to possibly organophosphates or fertilizer, maybe chlorine in his salad.
I still don't quite know
a variety of methods here. Is this going somewhere, or is the whole point that it can be so diverse in terms of method, and it can be so diverse in terms of geography, and it can be so diverse in terms of target that, in fact, the point is no one is safe via any method we use?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard for me to say what exists currently, because I think the Russians do a good job of keeping this sort of stuff under wraps. I've been told by former Russian intelligence officers about, you know, basically research and development departments where these sorts of tools are developed, where the umbrella, you know, with the Ricin, tablet was developed, you know, where poisons are developed and perfected and used, as the Brits noted in the aftermath of the Skripal case, you know, they had intelligence indicating that the Russians had been practicing and perfecting the use of poison smeared on door handles, and we saw this case in both the Bulgarian case and the Skripal case that the poisons appeared to have been, in the Bulgarian case it was smeared on his car door handle, and in the Skripal case the poison was smeared on the front door handle. So I think that they're, you know, like any other sort of technology, they're constantly perfecting and researching new ways to try to eliminate people, both to send a message and to sort of get away with it, right? You know, I think sometimes, you know, they want it to be known that, you know, this person, you know, that they went after a person and got him. I think in the Skripal case, you know, there are a number of different assessments, but, you know, as has been described to me, had they been successful, Skripal would have exposed himself to this, gone into his home, locked his door, and died, and people wouldn't have found him for days. Right. And by that point, the substance would have dissipated, and there would have been no reason to believe that he had been the target of an assassination. There have been a number of suspicious deaths of Russian, particularly in the UK, that, you know, the police just don't have the evidence on, but that certainly raise a lot of questions.
What about you? You're traveling and working in a lot of these same countries where people are under threat. You're talking to people around those people and trying to uncover other stories. How do you feel about your own physical security, and how does someone like your mother sleep at night?
My mother doesn't sleep at night, hasn't slept at night since I started this line of work. But I do take, you know, as many precautions as I can take, you know, with my communications, with my personal safety. Not enough for my mother, unfortunately. She would prefer I reported about fashion or something like that. I think as all of these cases show, there's very little, you know, you can do, you know, to protect yourself. I operate under the assumption that, again, I'm not sort of doing enough to anger them to reach that point. But ultimately, you know, if somebody's going to get you, they're going to get you. And I don't think, you know, certainly if I touch a door handle and it's sticky, I'll rush to the hospital. But otherwise, I don't know that there's much you can do.
You've absorbed some of that Russian fatalism, haven't you? Well, thank you for joining us, and be safe so that you can join us again in the future.
Thank you. I will.
The Lawfare podcast is produced by the Lawfare Institute in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks to Michael Schwartz for joining us about this important topic. If you found something worthwhile in this conversation, please remember to share this episode on the social media of your choice to help us spread the word. And don't forget to check out The Impeachment, our distillation of the Senate trial of President Trump, on the podcast feed for The Report. And if you appreciate this podcast, all 500 regular episodes of it so far, please show it by supporting our nonprofit enterprise that pulls it all together, along with everything else we do here at Lawfare, which you can give to at lawfareblog.com/support-lawfare. Our editor and producer is Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineers this time were Hadley Baker and Jacob Schultz. And our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.